Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. At a critical bend in the Columbia River estuary, a company called Next Renewable Fuels Incorporated wants to build a renewable diesel refinery. The proposed refinery at Port Westward would be one of the largest producers of renewable diesel on the West Coast. While renewable diesel may sound like a promising sustainable form of energy, the process of converting feedstocks into a diesel fuel demands power, frack gas, and water, and would damage the sensitive ecosystem of wetlands and farmlands that it impacts. Today, we talk again with Aaron Saylor, staff attorney with Columbia Riverkeeper, along with Columbia County activists Brandon Schilling and Jasmine Lilich, about why they are raising alarms about this project. Aaron, Jasmine, and Brandon, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having us.
I think a lot of people in Portland, they might be getting a little bit more familiar with the idea that there's this industrial park called Port Westward that's north of Portland, but not really. It's been off the radar as we focus on large fossil fuel projects that are much closer to Portland or that are just better known like Jordan Cove. So today I wanted to talk about what's going on at Port Westward besides the other things we've already talked about on the show recently and why it's a concern. So Aaron, why don't you start by just giving us some background on what Port Westward is and what the latest issues are out there?
Sure. So what Port Westward is it's a deep water port that's located at a bend in the Columbia River estuary. And that's an area of the river which extends from the mouth of the river in the Pacific Ocean all the way up to Bonneville Dam. The Columbia River Estuary is a federally designated estuary of national significance under the Clean Water Act. It's home to 13 species of endangered salmon and steelhead, as well as numerous other species of fish, birds, amphibians, and mammals, including the Columbia white-tailed deer, which are listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. This is an area of the river that public and private entities have invested billions of dollars to restore endangered and threatened salmonids, including significant investment in riparian and wetland restoration projects in the estuary. It's also a really, there are numerous important fishing sites in this area around Port Westward where locals and tribal members have been fishing for generations to feed their families. The other really interesting thing about Port Westward is it's surrounded by very, very high value farmland. There's numerous world-class mint and organic blueberry farms out there. There's tree farms and pasture lands. And I'm sure, you know, I'm not sure if this is something you've touched on in some of your other shows before, but across the state, Oregon is losing farmland at an alarming rate. So in the 10-year period between 1997 and 2017, the state lost about 85,000 acres or about 133 square miles of farmland each year. So we really need to see the state and local jurisdictions prioritizing the protection of farmland, not the construction of more industrial facilities. So what we're seeing right now, instead of the prioritization of farmland, is they are right now considering siting a new renewable diesel production facility, which is being put forward by Next Renewable Energy or Next Energy. Specifically what they're looking to do, this would be one of the largest producers of renewable diesel on the West Coast. For those of you who aren't familiar with renewable diesel, I have to say diving into this project, it was definitely a learning curve for me. I'm sure we've heard all kinds of different terms thrown around. There's renewable diesel, there's biodiesel. Basically, renewable diesel is a form of biodiesel that is more easily used to replace conventional diesel than biodiesel would be. So what they do is they take feedstock like animal fat or vegetable oil, using hydrogen, they turn it into a fuel that can replace conventional diesel in cars and trucks.
Well, is renewable diesel a good thing? I mean, is this something that we should be looking to be as part of the portfolio of our renewable future?
You know, it really depends on the specifics. You know, like they say, the devil's in the details. In general, it's thought that renewable diesel has about half the life cycle of greenhouse gas emissions of petroleum-based fuels. But again, it really comes down to how it's produced. Are the feedstocks, are they using virgin feedstocks where they're growing crops specifically to turn it into fuel? Or are they using, you know, spent vegetable oil like from your McDonald's French fries? You know, how are they doing that? There's also the concern, especially with Next, is the hydrogen that they use to produce the fuel. There's a couple different ways that it can be done. There's what's called green hydrogen, where the hydrogen is basically produced using renewable energy, which obviously has a lighter impact on the planet. And then there's gray hydrogen, which is what Next is proposing to do here, where they're going to use large quantities of natural gas to produce the hydrogen necessary to make the renewable fuel. So in Next's case, they anticipate burning about 14.2 million cubic feet per day of fracked gas to produce hydrogen. So to put that into some context, on a daily basis, the average US household uses about 168 cubic feet of gas per day. So Next's daily gas use would serve about 85,000 households per day. So that's a lot of gas.
Well, this sort of sounds like just one more frack gas project being proposed for the Northwest under the guise of renewable diesel.
It does, yeah, a little bit.
I'm wondering if that's part of the approach that you're taking in evaluating it and organizing around it.
It is one piece of it, but really, Columbia Riverkeeper, we're not opposed to renewable fuels. We need to make some shifts away from petroleum-based fuel products. Our concern and what we're opposed to is this particular project in this particular location being brought by this particular company.
So let's talk about some of the other concerns that you have about why this project is not a good fit for Columbia County and for the Clatskanie area.
Yeah, so, in terms of obviously the impact on the farmland is huge. In order to construct the facility, they're planning to fill over 118 acres of wetlands and other waterways just to build the footprint of the facility. They are also one of the really big issues that came up a lot in the land use proceedings just recently in the last couple weeks is the rail traffic that they're planning to draw. So they propose building what they're referring to as a rail branch line, which to most folks sounds like a single rail track that goes from the main line down to the facility and helps the trains get there. If you look at the plans, what they're actually proposing looks a lot more like a rail yard. I think they have 12 different rail lines there. During the county land use hearing, the project proponents admitted that they could hold up to 400 rail cars at a time in this area. And so there's a lot of concerns about, exactly what they're using this rail line for, how much product is going to be moved through it, how safe is it, and then what is the impact going to be on the surrounding farmers that have to get their product to market if there's these mile-long trains going by?
That sort of sounds like an old story, because these mile-long trains have been a concern for other facilities that actually exist out in Clatskanie or between Rainier and Clatskanie and that have been proposed. So is there any difference, or is this just going to be adding insult to injury? And I want Jasmine and Brandon to jump in since you guys are there on the ground in Clatskanie. So what is your take on the kind of impacts this is going to have?
Well, in regards to the rail use, just to, because a question kind of floated up there that we can address really quickly. Specifically, in the Port of Columbia County's lease, Next is not permitted to use unit trains. And so a unit train is 100 cars. So now the language they're using is jumbo manifest trains, which essentially means you go under the allotted amount and tag on a few extra cars with maybe some logs or any other commodity, and suddenly it's permitted. So what we've really stumbled upon in specific to the rail use is this fact that the entire South County essentially has no idea what's coming. We will be impacted by the rail, but the rail kind of fought it once it leaves South County, it kind of parallels the river. And so it doesn't really go through Clatskanie, but it does affect the farmers out there. And we're just pretty blown away at the lack of information and participation from South County in regards to rail use.
I wanted to get just a little bit of geography laid out because, like, a lot of listeners probably are not really familiar that much with Columbia County and what the geography is. So when you refer to South County, what is that and where is this facility going to be in relationship to the rest of Columbia County?
Well, essentially, this facility is at the tip-top of Columbia County. So it's about as far into the cul-de-sac as you could get. It's sort of the dead end, the northernmost dead end of Columbia County. And so South County is the Highway 30 corridor that the rails parallel. And so that's St. Helens, Rainier, Scappoose, and so on. And recently, of course, probably in correlation, likely in correlation with this project, they've been doing a rail safety assessment. And there's a lot of crossings. There's a lot of people on both sides of the tracks, and there's a lot of opportunity for all kinds of interruptions. And the speed limit is very different in South County because it's more populated. And there's a lot of really serious issues that aren't being appropriately addressed.
I'd like you to, again, describe what Port Westward is. Dan Sears was on a few weeks ago, and he gave a really eloquent description of what this part of the river is like. But, Jasmine, could you describe what makes Port Westward so special?
Oh, it's beautiful. I mean, it's full of rich type 1, type 2, type 3 soils. There's farmers out there producing things that you couldn't produce anywhere else in the state and arguably even the United States as a whole.
Stuff like what?
Like mint and like mint that is regeneratively grown for 50 or 60 years. It was really hard to do anywhere else. And these soils have been created, you know, by 150,000 years. You can't just go and buy these soils at your local garden store. the Columbia River, you know, contributed to that.
What is the Columbia River doing at that point? Because that's one of the things that I get the impression is what's really majestic about this area is the kind of point that it is in the Columbia River.
The best thing to do is go on Google Maps. And what I really like to do every once in a while is zoom in on the proposed industrial site and then take a moment at each level of zooming out. And you start to see this amazingly vast pattern where each bend of the river has this sort of washout where when we have these periodic floodings, the water and the silt and the dead animals that are in the river, you know, all the nutrition, all the beautiful, the stuff you just really can't manufacture washes into the land and it settles and the flooding recedes and you're left with this pristine soil that you just, they're unique. They're incredibly unique. And so, yeah, so this is a bend. It's a jutting portion of land into the Columbia, and it's very obvious. And this isn't the only spot that looks like this. The closer you get to the estuary, sort of the more spread out these temporary floodplains become, and you can really see the difference in topography. It's very obvious.
It's also that the river itself is kind of doing an amazing thing right around then too, isn't it? Which is what makes it such a rich fishing area.
Yeah, the fishing in general and just the recreation out there. We have kayakers and boaters and then a whole slew of wildlife.
Just in a very special place.
Yeah, it really is.
It's majestic.
Yeah, and we just produced a little movie of the locals talking about it, which is very touching. So look that up if you go to Save Port Westward's Facebook page.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Aaron Saylor, who's staff attorney with Columbia Riverkeeper, and Columbia County activist Jasmine Lilich and Brandon Schilling about a renewable diesel refinery being proposed at Port Westward along the Columbia Estuary. Aaron, I wanted to talk a little bit more about what is going on in general at Port Westward, because it's been the site of contentious plans for development. The one that's probably best known outside of Columbia County is the proposed world's largest methanol refinery, the last of the three world's largest methanol refineries proposed for the Northwest, the only one that hasn't been killed so far. So what is Port Westward? Who owns it? And why is it trying to become such an industrial center?
Yeah, so Port Westward is part of the Columbia County, the Port of Columbia County. They, you know, right now they have a few industrial facilities there. There is a PGE has a power plant. The Port Westward Generating Station is there. There's also what we refer to as Global Partners, which is the owner of the Columbia Pacific Biorefinery. They have had a long storied history that Columbia Riverkeeper has been fighting against them for a while. Despite their name, they traditionally have been operating as a oil by rail transloading facility. So they're not doing that right now. They are allegedly doing renewable diesel as well. But there's always the concern that they will shift back to doing oil by rail. And kind of the interesting thing about the Global Partners facility as well is that Next Energy, so Global Partners either owns or has lease rights to the dock that's right there at Port Westward. And I think we just to back up a little bit. So one of the reasons why Next Energy wants to be in Port Westward is for access to this deep water dock. They're arguing that they need access to the tanker vessels. Even though now it sounds like they're planning to maybe use trains more than vessels, we're not really clear. That's one of our concerns about the project is they seem to be flip-flopping on what they're telling everybody they're going to do. But their ultimate plan is to send most of this fuel down to California, where California has a low carbon fuel rule in place. So there's a higher demand for renewable diesel down there right now. But this dock that's there at Port Westward is controlled largely by Global Partners. So they have all of the equipment there that they need to unload the vessel tankers. So Next would actually or does have an agreement with Global Partners where Global Partners would be the ones unloading the fuel from the tanker vessels and ultimately refilling it as well. So there is going to be some level of connection between these two facilities. Which obviously leaves us with some concerns about, you know, if Global Partners is already handling or has in their permits to handle oil, you know, what happens if Next decides to flip their script later on too?
Who is Next actually? Global Partners is kind of well known as a kind of notorious national, if not multinational, oil company, basically. And I know they do a lot of nasty things in New York State as well as here in Oregon. But who is Next? Because I never heard about them until Dan Sears told me about them last month.
Yeah, so the interesting thing about Next Energy is it seems to be the latest iteration of projects put forward by the same handful of investors and project backers that have had kind of a string of similar projects that they've proposed throughout the area. One of the kind of big reasons why we're so concerned about these particular project proponents is that they were involved in the Transmesis facility, which was a biodiesel project that had operated in Odessa, Washington for less than a year before the company fired all of its employees and abandoned the facility. And it wasn't even, you know, the state regulators didn't realize that the facility was abandoned until they went to do an inspection, showed up and found the doors locked. When they were eventually able to get into the facility, they found that the company had just left behind a serious chemical waste management issue with open and leaking storage drums everywhere. They ran out of town, leaving behind an unpaid tax bill of about $1.6 million. State and federal regulators had to step in and clean up this mess at a cost of about $400,000 from EPA's Superfund program. So these folks that are now putting forward the Next Energy proposal still aren't taking no responsibility for the mess that they left behind in Odessa, Washington. They just keep finger pointing, saying it was somebody else's concern, somebody else's problem. They were the ones at fault, but that is not what the regulators have found.
I might be conflating two different things, but do they have any connection at all to some of the players in Northwest Innovation Works? I know that V. Gottlieb, who was the CEO of Northwest Innovation Works, was involved with some other operation in Eastern Washington that sounds like it had a very similar story.
I'm not aware of that connection. Dan Sears might know. Yeah, there's definitely, you know, also at Port Westward, Northwest Innovation Works, there has been some talk about them potentially building a facility at Port Westward at all, as well, that would be in large part contingent on the rezone moving forward. I don't have any information really on how far along that is or how realistic it is, but it is definitely a concern that we have kind of floating around in the back of our minds, because as part of the permitting process for the next energy facility, particularly with respect to the Army Corps of Engineers dredge and fill permit, Clean Water Act 404 permit, the Army Corps of Engineers recently decided that they are going to do, as part of their analysis under the National Environmental Policy Act, they are going to do a full environmental impact statement, which is a really big deal that they've decided to do this full environmental impact statement. Usually what happens with these projects is the agency will decide, you know, it's going to have a little bit of effect on the environment, but not a big one. So we're just going to do what's called an environmental assessment, or an EA. And here the Army Corps has already decided that the potential impacts of the project are significant enough that they're going to do a full environmental impact statement, which involves looking at potential cumulative effects with all the other projects that are already in the area or are proposed for the area. So we've definitely brought up the fact that, well, there may or may not be plans to build this giant Northwest Innovation Works methanol facility here as well. That's something that the Army Corps should take into account when they're deciding whether or not to site this project as well.
I'm curious what motivated the Army Corps to go ahead with a full environmental impact statement.
You know, so they had initially put the draft permit out for public comment. They received significant public comment, both from Columbia Riverkeeper and from folks like Jasmine and Brandon and community members, tribal members, just raising all of the concerns that we have with respect to the project. And one thing, too, that we haven't touched on yet is, you know, Brandon talked about how this facility is really prone to flooding. So the area is actually managed by a drainage district, the Beaver Drainage District, which regulates the flow of water to these high-value agricultural lands. So there's a series of dikes, very complicated system. I couldn't even begin to try to describe it. But the drainage system, or the drainage district, is super concerned about what's going to happen not only when you Next Energy comes in and paves over 118 acres of wetlands to build their facility, but they're planning to mitigate that wetlands impact by building additional wetlands, basically 400 and some odd acres of additional wetlands within the drainage district. And no one's really taken a hard look at, well, what is this going to mean for the drainage district? Is it going to flood the farmland more? Is it going to lead to pooling where we'll have bacteria build up? Or is it going to flood nearby houses and community members? And there's just so many unknowns that Next hasn't really dug into or hasn't provided information for. So this is all stuff that would come up during that environmental impact statement process.
May I speak just a little bit more to that? Two points I'd like to raise. One is that this is really the first time the Department of State Lands has authorized mitigation within the drainage district. And it's at an exponential ratio. It's almost a 4-to-1 ratio for mitigation.
What does that mean?
It means that for every acre that they plan to industrialize for their site, they need to mitigate 3.9 acres of wetland. And so traditionally, the Department of State Lands has not permitted that sort of mitigation within a drainage district. So this is sort of an unprecedented situation here.
But they couldn't find any, you know, plots of land that were big enough to do this mitigation site. So this is where they ended up.
Well, it just sounds like a very crazy idea that you'd be building a wetland in a drainage district. I mean, the idea of the drainage district is to get rid of the excess water. And basically, I mean, that's what probably this whole area was once all wetland, right? Including the drainage area.
Well, and to make it even crazier, the closest project that the Army Corps has worked on like this was about 50 acres plus or minus. So we're talking about 461 acres here. This is a project that they've never looked at before, admittedly. So add that into the fire and it's, the whole thing just is completely preposterous. And, mostly because of the speed at which the permitting process is moving forward.
How is this going forward? I mean, who is in charge of permitting this thing? And how much does the state weigh in? And how much of this is locally happening in Columbia County?
Well, it's really interesting. This whole permitting process, there's been a lot of horse before the cart. And every time I say that, my elders say, oh, yeah, well, that's nothing new. And I believe that. And I totally understand that. But, you know, one example is when public comment was open for the wetland mitigation with the Department of State Lands. Their proposal was only 10 to 15% complete, next proposal. So how can anybody comment on a project that's 10 to 15% complete? Other issues regarding the need for prerequisite permits from the DEQ for other permits, and they're moving forward with these processes without these prerequisite permits. I didn't say that very eloquently, but essentially, there, in every article you read and every interview you read from Next, there is this massive push, and mostly because investors are wanting to get to market and mostly because that's going to be what makes them competitive. So they were, you know, when you asked them in the beginning, they were already supposed to be in production right now. And so here we are now with this final stage, and Columbia County commissioners are supposed to be permitting the land use permit, and we don't even have the environmental impact study, we don't have the air quality report, we don't have a lot of pertinent information that is seemingly relevant to approving this project. And to add some salt in the wound, most of the concerns that we, Safeport Westward, the community, Columbia Riverkeepers, Thousand Friends of Oregon, most of the issues that we've brought forth to the county specifically, legally, they're allowed to say that these concerns don't meet the applicable criteria. So they're really, they're hiding behind the law to sort of cherry pick which issues they want to address. And the ones that they want to address are certainly important, but it's not the full scope by any means.
This all sounds very familiar. It seems like every one of the frack gas projects that's been proposed in the Northwest, that there's lots and lots of legwork that hasn't been done by these companies. And a lot of their rationale to state regulators about why this will be good for the community is based on basically hot air. So I'm just curious about why they can't be pinned down and get some of that hot air back into some solid balloons.
You asked earlier who Next was, and I would add to the leadership team that one of these gentlemen is actually runs a business, a turn and burn business, where he evaluates companies and then sells them. So here we are, turn and burn.
Well, you're listening to Locust Focus on KPU Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Aaron Salo, who's staff attorney with Columbia Riverkeeper, and Columbia County activists Jasmine Lilich and Brandon Schilling about a renewable diesel refinery being proposed at Port Westward along the Columbia Estuary. Jasmine, you mentioned before we started recording today that you're a fifth-generation Kalatskanai. So I wanted to get your long-range perspective on how you see this project impacting a way of life that goes back in your family for, well over 100 years, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I see Kalatskanai having a rich agricultural history. And I came from a sheep farmer. I didn't come from any farmers, you know, out on the Beaver Drainage District land. But, you know, all farmers are connected. And And you look at, you know, the historical photos from out on that land and what Clatskanie looked like 100 years ago, and it was agriculturally rich. And that's kind of the uphill battle that we're facing, because a lot of the problems that we are having is that this land did get zoned industrial, and we can't really reverse that, right? And so a lot of our elders are saying that this is what this land is for right now. I'm president of the Clatskanie Farmers Market this year. Brandon and I have a farm-to-table food business, a certified kitchen, and we work with the farmers around here to promote small organic agriculture. And that is what we see the future of Clatskanie as, and really the future of Columbia County, because it comes back to these soils and what our natural resources are and how we can capitalize on that. And we moved here from Southern Oregon 2 years ago, and we moved because of the climate crisis. And we watched our friends down there lose their farms because of drought and because of fires. And it's real, you know, it's happening. And for Oregon to make a decision to choose industry over prime agricultural land right now, I really think is an embarrassment to what we really need to be focusing on.
Well, I know that none of you are land use lawyers, and your legal expertise is, I guess, elsewhere. But I want to see if you can jump into this, because, I've been doing a lot of work over the years about Oregon's land use laws, and I know that one of the main goals of those laws is to protect farmland. So when you mention how much farmland's been lost, and I first of all want to see if you know, have a rough idea of what it's being lost to, and then talk about how to use Oregon's land use laws to start to protect farmland again. Do you want to jump in on that, Erin?
Yeah, I can try. You know, I think the loss in farmland is largely due to shifts towards industrial uses. With respect to the big push to rezone an extra 137 acres of this high value farmland that we've been talking about at Port Westward. As you know, and as you've talked about on your other shows, you know, the county has approved the port's rezone application 3 times now. Each time Columbia Riverkeeper has challenged that county's decision before the Land Use Board of Appeals, or LUBA, on grounds that the county failed to consider the impacts that this new industrial land would have on the river and neighboring agricultural uses. So, you know, there are ways, there are, you know, a lot of requirements built into Oregon land use laws to protect agricultural lands, to protect these existing uses. I think what we're seeing in a lot of areas is what the Port of Columbia County is trying to do here, where they're just trying to kind of meet the minimal standards, like, oh yeah, we consider that, move on. And if you don't have groups like Columbia Riverkeeper, 1,000 Friends of Oregon coming in and saying, wait, you didn't really consider that, you kind of did a halfway job there, they tend to get away with it. And it's really a sad situation.
Well, I think we're seeing across the state, as you were mentioning, all the loss of farmland. I'm trying to visualize that this is not just happening in Columbia County. I mean, it's obviously happening in Prineville, where Facebook has a major server farm, and the Dalles is now home to Google, and other what were once rural communities are basically been taken over by high tech. And it's also happened for sure just west of Portland in Washington County. I wonder how these competing interests can work something out, because it does seem that that when the Oregon land use laws were first formulated in the 1970s, I don't think anybody imagined the kind of industrial development that would happen on farmland. And I wonder how that can, there can be a conversation that starts to bring back the original values that these laws are supposed to protect.
Yeah, I think a lot of this, unfortunately, comes down to the really difficult decision that these counties and local jurisdictions are faced, where it's the perennial concern about protection of the environment, protection of farmland, and jobs. And so, you know, the local jurisdictions are thinking, this great big company, they're going to come in, they're behind the scenes, you know, they're promising the school that they're going to build them a STEM lab, and they're, you know, promising to build a new water tower for somebody else, or they're going to bring all of this tax revenue, and they're going to bring workers in that are going to live in the community and shop in the community. And that's really appealing to the decision makers on the county boards that have to make these decisions. But I agree with you. You know, we need to find a way where there isn't so many backdoor deals and promising happening, and it isn't all coming down to money, but we're actually thinking, you know, how can we sustainably build these communities? What kinds of companies can we have that come in that are, you know, forward moving, you know, helpful for the environment, helpful for the community? But unfortunately, that's just not what we're seeing. It's all really coming down to money and jobs and backdoor deals.
Could I add a little bit to that? Because that's, I think that is the perfect segue to, you know, focusing on solutions. We spend a lot of energy whacking at the branches of evil, so to say. And what Jasmine and I are really looking forward to bringing to the table is this idea that money is not the only form of capital. There's a really great organization out there, wealthworks.org. It's a new spin on sort of an old concept, but I think for us to realize that money is increasingly concentrated, and that is because of a process. And I would argue that's the process of industrialization. And once that money is concentrated, it's very hard for it to come back to communities. And so, like you're speaking to, Aaron, when these companies come in and they promise these jobs and this massive tax revenue, a lot of that is smoke and mirrors. And I think really what we as local leaders need to start prioritizing is smaller scale action and smaller scale development and actually investing in our community instead of investing in industrial sites and waiting for a big sugar daddy to come along and make it rain. We really need to be building diversity like a rainforest in our community, because imagine that this company does move forward and we put all of our eggs in that one basket: our schools, our emergency services, our roads, on and on and on. And just like what happened in Odessa, if the market crashes, if technology innovates rapidly, exponentially, like it is doing, it, technology is begetting itself. Artificial intelligence is through the roof. We can't even fathom the technologies that are just around the corner. That's a very risky basket to put all of our eggs into. And that's really one of the points we're trying to hit home with our local leadership, is we have to actually think about what real wealth is. And money is not wealth. Money is a form of capital. It's a tool. But it's not the only form of capital. And that's the conversation we have to open.
And we've had a huge influx of new people come to our county because of the pandemic, because of the climate crisis. You know, there's a great migration happening. And I don't think that our county has slowed down for a second to reevaluate their priorities based on that, and what's really important. And we're in the regional food system conversations. And, you know, there's this big movement of trying to make the North Coast self-reliant in their food system. And one of the biggest obstacles right now is land, surprisingly, because of the timber companies, you know, own all the, there's not enough farmland right now for the North Coast to provide the food that they need for themselves. And with this Cascadia earthquake coming, you know, that's a big concern. So why are we getting rid of farmland again?
That's a very good question. I mean, I was just thinking about the fact that when the Cascadia earthquake happens, that the North Coast is going to be cut off from the rest of the world for, it could be up to a couple of years. So it seems like it's really vital that you produce your own food system. Now, in neighboring Clatsop County, there was a period, because there was the same kind of push for industrialization in Clatsop County 20 years ago. And that got fought off by the community organizing. I understand Clatsop County is now reverting, and the county commission, I'm not sure if it has majority of conservatives on it, but it's certainly not as progressive as it was a few years ago. I wonder how you get new leadership in Columbia County, because it seems that this move to industrialize Columbia County is not coming from the residents, it's coming from the county commission and their cronies.
Well, that's a dynamic conversation, because what we've experienced is that a lot of the major institutions and organizations whose boards of directors and leadership consists of citizens are sort of roped into these decisions because of these big promises. And I think what's really particularly interesting in Columbia County is this push that we had. This is sort of pre-Jasmine and I, although Jasmine's family has been here for five generations, but the urban renewal districts essentially diverting essential tax money from schools and emergency services to develop this industrial playground at Port Westward and manufacturing a sense of desperation. And so these institutions need money, absolutely. And they're put in a position where they are sort of held hostage to decisions like this, where, unless you say yes to this industrial development, then you're not going to get the tax dollars you need. And so it's not that it's only the leadership and cronies, so to speak. It's that it's a relationship problem. It's like a dysfunctional relationship that we have between the uppermost government leadership and sort of the middle of the road leadership, like our school board and the fire board and so on.
I've got the impression that there's kind of an uprising of farmers in your community that are opposed to the further industrialization of Port Westward. How does that fit in, and how can that start to have a bigger voice?
Well,
that's what
we're working on right now. And there's a lot of potential to create an alternative or a new economy based around, this is something that Jasmine and I have brought to the table as far as rewind a little bit, and let's talk about, well, what is renewable diesel? Renewable diesel is actually promoting the problem that it's claiming to cause. We're bulldozing the Amazon rainforest to grow soy. And so, when you look at reducing demand for petroleum, oh my gosh, clothes, the amount of petroleum that goes into fast fashion is incredible. Let's talk about plastic packaging. Let's talk about all these other really simple, actually, approaches to reducing our petroleum usage. And that's not to say that the renewable diesel industry couldn't completely change face and actually become something green. If we can shift to regenerative farming practices, I'm all for it. I think that would be fantastic. But the truth of the matter is, the market for soy and corn and canola is 80 to 90% and beyond dominated by genetically modified crops. And those are chemically intensive. They're heavy pesticides, heavy nitrogen fertilizers, and that's destroying the soil. And that's destroying the soil's ability to sequester carbon. And it's promoting greenhouse gas emissions. And so really, I love this notion in permaculture that the problem is the solution. And so perhaps we see ourselves, Klatske and I used to grow flax for linen. So perhaps we see ourselves growing feedstocks for fuel or feedstocks for fiber or any feedstocks for food, feedstocks for humans. There's a lot of potential. And just the cherry on top of that, bringing it back to the concentration of wealth in this country and in the world, there is an insane amount of money being thrown around, and some of it is going towards good projects, and some of it is going towards mindless projects. And I think what we're experiencing right now, as Aaron said so well, it's not that the whole thing is bad. We're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but this company at this location with this proposal is the problem.
You're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with Aaron Saylor, staff attorney with Columbia Riverkeeper, and Columbia County activists Jasmine Lilich and Brandon Schilling about a renewable diesel refinery being proposed at Port Westward along the Columbia Estuary. Erin, I wonder if you have any words of wisdom or consolation to these folks in Columbia County from the lessons that Columbia Riverkeepers learned from working in Kalama in Cowlitz County in Washington about stopping big frack gas projects and dealing with the same arguments that Columbia County is being faced with by their political and social leadership.
Yeah, I mean, the words of wisdom are, you know, you guys are doing an awesome job. First of all, you guys are just amazing activists, and it has just been so amazing to, you know, watch you and watch the farmers and the drainage district and how everyone is really coming together to oppose this project. You know, it is kind of depressing sometimes where we think like we're putting all of this work into it and there's so much opposition to it, and it's sort of a foregone conclusion that the county's gonna approve the land use applications. But the land use application is just one step of the process. Like, we've already convinced the Army Corps of Engineers to do an environmental impact statement, which was a big deal. You know, even if they get the zoning from the county, they can't build if they don't have the 404 permit from the Army Corps of Engineers. They can't build if they don't get the air permit from the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. So there's other processes that we can continue to track and fight. And so that's what we'll just keep doing here. And, you know, if folks who are listening want ways to get involved going forward, we are in a little bit of a lull right now where we're waiting for the county land use decision. It's expected to come out on February 23rd. But we are now expecting that the Army Corps of Engineers will put forward a public notice regarding the environmental impact statement. There'll be opportunities to comment on that. We expect the draft air permit to be coming out soon from Oregon DEQ, so there'll be ways to comment on that as well, which Riverkeeper will be, you know, developing fact sheets and easy ways for folks to get involved and to comment if they want to. So, you know, for right now, become a Columbia Riverkeeper member, visit our website. There is, if you go to our main website, which is columbiariverkeeper.org, on the right-hand corner on the main page, there's a place that you can read more about the project. We have a fax document there. And just sign up for action alerts so that once these permits start coming out for public comment, you know, you can be in the know and we can help you participate in those projects.
Well, I want to step back a bit and just ask, why should people in Portland be concerned about this?
Well, I mean, it's all connected. We're all connected. So, you know, if we have a major spill on the river, it's going to impact Portland. It's going to impact the farmland. You know, the mint that we're talking about and the blueberries that we're talking about, these could be products that you're buying in the store and you don't even realize it until suddenly you go and you can't find your favorite. You know, from what I understand, the Sealy Mint Farm makes really amazing mint chocolates that I need to find that people buy here in Portland, you know? So, you know, the access to food and access to local food is a really big driver for a lot of people and why we live here in Oregon and why we live here in Portland. And it would be such a shame if we see all of this farmland that's all around us, that's such a, you know, important, valuable piece of being an Oregonian, to disappear in favor of industrialization.
Well, I'd just like to invite the people from Portland out to Klatskanai to come visit our farmers market June through September and meet these farmers and meet us. It's a really good time. And that demographic change that I was talking about, I mean, there was a lot of people that moved here from Portland, you know, to have a rural life. I know with the lockdowns, you know, things got really intense for people. And so to keep this rural way of living accessible for people, I think is just really important. And to throw in, you can also always email saveportwestward@gmail.com, and Brandon and I are happy to communicate with you and send you information. And yeah.
Well, I'm thinking that for a lot of people, they think of the Klatskanai area as it's kind of, as a friend of mine calls it, it's a drive-through town on your way to Astoria. And I remember having conversations with people over the many years I've lived here about their favorite route to get to Astoria. And some people would take Highway 26 and then up 101 to Astoria. And that's what I did for a while until the Silicon Forest stopped being a forest and started being basically parking lots and huge factories. and chip manufacturers. And I started going back on Highway 30 and discovered the Columbia River, the estuary. And to me, that is such a magical place. And I wonder if people can take a lesson from what happened along the Highway 26 corridor to see that that's not what you want to have happen on the Highway 30 corridor. Is that something you can sell as an idea of why to save your area?
Absolutely, yeah. And you know, we're trying to make a really fun pit stop in Klatsk, and we're opening a food hub, a food co-op, a venue space, a music spot. A lot of wonderful agritourism Airbnbs are popping up all over the place, glamping. You know, it's a fun place to hang out. And yeah, there are two ways to get to the coast, and we would like people to choose Highway 30.
Erin, I'm thinking still about all the lessons that have been learned in this area from fighting and stopping fossil fuel projects, the most recent one being ending the almost 18-year battle against Jordan Cove LNG, which also seemed like a done deal at the time. And I wonder what we can learn from what the ways that these communities have come together, and these are both in Kalama and in Coos Bay and in Coos County, that these are areas that are depressed. They've lost lots of jobs. They are being wooed excessively by the fossil fuel industry. What are some of your pointers to say to Columbia County about how to learn from the victories against Jordan Cove and against Kalama methanol?
I would say, you know, if we're directing this towards the county, you know, listen to your constituents. You know, if you go back to the land use hearings, the on the next energy proposal before the Board of Commissioners in Columbia County, the number of people coming out in opposition to the project were 2-1 over those that were in favor of it. So I think that the commissioners should listen to that. You know, what the county wants is important. If they're trying to, you know, and like Brandon said earlier, too, a lot of these jobs and a lot of the money that these industrial facilities are kind of dangling before the county, it's all smoke and mirrors. You know, a lot of their short-term construction jobs where those folks are going to come into the community and then leave again. The number of permanent positions that they create are very, very low. And they're often very, very technical positions that probably are not hiring people locally. They're bringing them in from other places. So just, you know, listen to what your community members are asking for, because they're a very, very important voice. And when we all rise up together, we can make a difference. And it's just, they're going to end up in a position where, you know, if they approve the land use rules, it doesn't mean they're not going to get overruled by all of these other permitting processes.
So once again, what's the next step, and what can people who are listening today do to help to stop this from stop next renewables from becoming situated in Klatskanai?
Yeah, so there should be a series of draft permits coming out soon. We're expecting the draft air permit from the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality to be coming out soon. There'll be an opportunity to comment on that. And then also the Army Corps of Engineers should be putting out their public notice regarding their decision to do an environmental impact statement. So there should also be a public process associated with that. Obviously, those are very, very technical processes, but Riverkeeper is here to help you navigate that. So if you become a member on our webpage, columbiariverkeeper.org, you can sign up to get information from us or sign up for action alerts. And we really help break these processes down into, you know, digestible, easy to understand, easy to participate in processes.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today. And we'll put a link to Columbia Riverkeeper on the Locust Focus website. And Jasmine and Brandon, if you can send me the link to your organization, I'll put that on the website as well.
You got it. Hey, and real quick, I just want to give a shout out to 1,000 Friends of Oregon, Dan Lawler. They've been paramount. And thank you, Erin. Thank you, Columbia Riverkeepers. We literally could not do any of this without you. So you are the fuel for our fire.
And thank you, Brandon, Jasmine, and Erin, for all the work that you're doing. And thanks for being on Locust Focus today.
Thanks, Barbara.
We've been talking with Aaron Saylor, staff attorney with Columbia Riverkeeper, and Columbia County activists Brandon Schilling and Jasmine Lilich. And you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community radio station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with members of Divest Oregon about the campaign to move the Oregon Treasury to divest from fossil fuel investments. We'll go out with a tune I wrote. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask.
Reshaping the land in the palm of your hand.